You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
To the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I am joined by my co-host, Michael Robert Kaditz. Today we are doing our part three on my series on progress, what it means, where it comes from, and how that affects our idea of the human condition and human societies. We did a first show on the conception of progress, outlining some of the problems and preconditions we might need to create a conception of progress. And then in part two, we talked about pre-Enlightenment ideas of progress, mainly from the perspective of Western philosophy. So considering thinkers and philosophers such as Plato, Aristotle, and Augustine or Augustine. We haven't gotten very far into philosophical views, but that's going to change today, because today we're talking about Enlightenment views on progress. So we have many, many ideas and many philosophers to interact with. So reading from part three of the article I found from Stanford, the writings on progress of the 18th century drew inspiration from the intellectual achievements in the 16th and 17th century. During this time, Europe witnessed an explosion of scientific and mathematical activity. In the natural sciences, the main fields of investigation were physics and astronomy. Major figures included Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton. Newton synthesized the work of the previous thinkers to bring the behavior of bodies on Earth and bodies in space under a single scientific law, the law of universal gravitation. This law states that two bodies attract each other in proportion to their masses and in inverse proportion to the square of the distance between them. The discoveries of these scientists had broad implications. First of all, the success of the new physics in unifying distinct phenomena and predicting behavior vindicated an underlying paradigm of scientific investigation and explanation. Second, the rapid gains encouraged an optimistic view of humans' capability to understand and shape their world. Here was a clear example of a communal activity in which one human built on and improved the work of his predecessor. The activity resulted in the discovery of a scientific law, the law of universal gravitation, of unprecedented power. So these are, in brief, the so-called scientific foundations of Enlightenment thinking, which, as they're making waves in Europe, start changing and having impacts on ideas of political life and social life. So the next section is on the French Enlightenment thinkers. For those of our audience who may not be familiar with underlying history here, in about the year 1500, we begin to see, if we go a bit further than that, up to the 1520s, 1530s, we begin to see signs of the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and we also begin to see the beginnings of colonization in the New World. So as we get through the 16th and 17th century, those two, I guess you could say, movements are making and progressing the attitudes in Europe. They're changing and making waves. France is known for rejecting the Protestant Reformation and maintaining its reliance on a state church, whereas countries like England, under the reign of Elizabeth I, become Protestant-dominated countries, and countries like Germany, which are actually not, Germany was not fully unified until the 19th century, more or less. So at this point, Germany is in little small pieces in terms of provinces, some of which are Catholic, some of which are Protestant. there's a lot going on in Europe at this period of time. Hopefully that historical backdrop gives you a little bit of idea of some of the things that are going on. There are significant religious differences in Europe at this time, and there's also been significant debate with regards to them. Literacy has somewhat improved. We're no longer in the Dark Ages. It's still quite challenging for anyone to achieve a good education without essentially the money to hire tutors and provide books, which, although we've had the printing press for quite a bit of time, one of the most interesting things, and it's unclear which is more connected to which, but the invention of the printing press, which corresponded with the development of the Protestant Reformation in Europe, had a massive effect on how much people could read and how economical it was for books to be produced, but it also had effects on religion and society. That's our historical backdrop. Europe in conflict. Europe grappling with new ideas and common people wondering what's going to happen next, because things are essentially in a state of flux most of the time. So two thinkers of the French Enlightenment, Anne Robert Jack Turgot and Baron de Lamont, and Marie Jean Charette and Maurice de Concordat, integrated reflection on scientific discoveries into their writing on progress. Turgot, a minister to Louis XVI, produced two influential works, A Philosophical Review of the Successive Advances of the Human Mind and On Universal History. Both authors suggest that philosophical progress is the deepest condition of scientific progress, influenced by British empiricism. Turgot and Cordat assert that all human knowledge is grounded in experience. According to Turgot, the renaissance of science first required an empiricist turn, abandoning the explanations appealing to faculties and essences. The scientific experiment then found its place as the centerpiece of the scientific method and the vehicle of further progress. Concordat reiterates these points and also provides a wealth of examples of recent scientific discoveries. Turgot and Concordat agree that scientific progress is dependent on mathematical and technological progress, and vice versa. So this is really drawing out some of the previous things that we've used to define progress. For instance, the idea of a universal history, a definition of progress. We can see here that a lot of the roots of a definition of progress come from scientific and mathematical and technological progress, and then it seems like that this works its way into, as that progress works its way into society, society alters and also undergoes some kind of transformative and progressive change. And it seems that these theorists view that that change is positive. Now, the notion of universal history is quite interesting here. During this period, there was this idea of universal knowledge, the idea that you could know basically everything about everything, and that to aspire to know everything was a great thing. One of the most famous examples of people who were universal people striving to have a wide breadth of knowledge and deep understanding of those topics, one of the foremost examples of that line of thinking is a person known as Leonardo da Vinci, who was both an artist and an accomplished inventor. He was also a theorist, and he loved tinkering with inventions. And so he would go from topic to topic, investing deep amounts of thought into each one and achieving high levels of mastery. So he was known for being a master of many different fields, which is where we get the idea of a universal man or a universal person.
I'm wondering whether progress is a euphemism for promotion and advancement of European Christian value set, whether progress is the word that's used to describe that. You use the term, the phrase, the commonly used phrase, Aaron, I think you were reading from the passage, shaping the world. That's a very European value, very Christian value, the idea that we would find the world as it is and then have a need to shape it, to change it, to become something different than what it is that better suits us. And you also talked about colonization, which is another characteristic of Christian Europe, the idea of colonizing the world, that it's not only the right, but even the obligation through manifest destiny, right? That God has directed people, Europeans, Christians, to transform the world into a Christian world, to convert the natives to Christianity. So I'm just wondering, and I'm playing the skeptic here, Aaron, I'm wondering, and I'm questioning the premise of the concept of progress. Is progress just a euphemism to try and connote something positive to what is actually a particular value, a peculiar value, peculiar to a particular culture, the culture that developed in the cultures, the related cultures that developed in Europe in a certain period of time, based, you know, with a Christian religion, had a peculiar value that it's time to start spreading around the world, colonizing, transforming and shaping the world, transforming and shaping, if not outright killing, ridding the world of the inhabitants that are backwards, primitive, wild. So I'm being the skeptic here and wondering whether we should just assume that progress is progress, or whether we should be questioning the idea of progress.
So Manifest Destiny, I'm just going to read from another article I found from history.com. Manifest Destiny is a phrase coined in 1845. It is the idea the United States is destined by God, its advocates believed, to expand its dominion and spread democracy and capitalism across the North American continent. So, and it says that this philosophy drove the 19th century U.S. territorial expansion and was used to justify the forced removal of, the article says, Native Americans or indigenous peoples and other groups from their homes. The rapid expansion of the United States intensified the issue of slavery as new states were added to the Union, leading to the outbreak of the U.S. Civil War. So it's a very interesting question to think about whether the Enlightenment values, which we will talk more of later, of that have developed a concept of progress, might have contributed and led to the idea of Manifest Destiny. I would still say that they don't fall into the exact same category, but there is some overlap there, and I think you'd be correct to see that. I would also like to point out, and this is something that I learned as I was doing some research and preparing for the show, that the ideas of progress and justice are multifaceted. You can see them from multiple perspectives. And they, to some degree, are linked to cultures. And so when Michael was saying, well, this idea of progress is fundamentally European, he's correct. It is linked to European culture. But as you said before on the show, Michael, we have the question, especially as philosophers, we have to think about this kind of carefully, of what is our definition of a culture? Because there are, if we were to go by national boundaries or even by linguistic boundaries, historical linguistic studies, we would see that, for instance, French culture and traditional values could be very different than German traditional values, different from English traditional values. And even, especially back this far in Europe's history, as I said, Germany hasn't yet emerged as a united nation. So lots of there's a lot of complexity here in history, and we have to be careful as philosophers not to, you know, lump everything together, not lump manifest destiny and progress into being the exact same category when I think they represent different things. Do you think we would be fair in saying that?
I think that the American, you know, manifestation of manifest destiny, the American, the way it emerged in the United States is just a continuation in a long history, being that the roots of the United States were European. To make my point, I have a couple of things here. One, in AD 1493, the Pope, that's Pope Alexander VI, issued a papal bull or decree known as Inter Cetera, in which he authorizes Spain and Portugal to colonize the Americas and its native peoples as subject. The decree asserts the right of Spain and Portugal to colonize, convert, and enslave. It also justifies the enslavement of Africans. He quoted directly from the Pope's decree here. Out of our own soul, largest and certain knowledge, and out of the fullness of our apostolic power, by the authority of Almighty God conferred upon us and Blessed Peter and the vicarship of Jesus Christ, which we hold on earth, do by tenor of these presents, should any of said islands have been found by your envoys and captains, give, grant, and assign to you and your heirs and successors, kings of Castile and Leon, forever, together with all their dominions, cities, camps, places, and villages, and all rights, jurisdictions, and appurtenances, all islands and mainlands found and to be found, discovered and to be discovered towards the west and the south, by drawing and establishing a line from the Arctic Pole, namely the north, to the Antarctic Pole, namely the south, no matter where the said mainlands and islands are found, and to be found in the direction of India, on and on and on with the, you know, with the geography. These be in the actual possession of any Christian king or prince up to the birthday of our Lord Jesus Christ, just passed, from which the present year 1493 begins. Anyway, that's one example of direct religious decree toward expansionism, colonialism. And then here from another article, khanacademy.org online, K-H-A-N Academy. Historians generally recognize three motives for European exploration and colonization in the New World: God, gold, and glory. Religious motivations can be traced all the way back to the Crusades, the series of religious wars between the 11th and 15th centuries, during which European Christians sought to claim Jerusalem as an exclusively Christian space. Europeans also searched for optimal trade routes to lucrative Asian markets and hoped to gain global recognition for their country. The the Crusades provided the religious ideology for their Reconquista, which in turn inspired Atlantic colonization. The Reconquista or Reconquest refers to the 800 years of violence and expulsion of Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula after the failed Crusades. So, let's see. Partly in the strongly Catholic nations of Spain and Portugal, religious zeal motivated the rulers to convert Native Americans and sanctify Christian global dominance. So I think there's a line that we can draw all the way back to the Crusades and before, all the way up to the colonization of North America and then the establishment of the United States and the principle of the doctrine of manifest destiny, a line of conversion, expansionism, sort of this assumed right that Europeans believe they had, Christians believe they had, to dominate the whole world. And so how does this fit into progress? So I'm asking, Aaron, I'm asking somewhat rhetorically here, is that what we mean by progress? Is progress simply the fulfillment or the enactment of Christian expansionism, European expansionism, colonization, shaping the world to suit Christianity. Is that what we mean by progress, or is there something that we can glean, that we can extract from the idea of progress that's not simply reshaping the world?
I think that's a very interesting question, Michael. I think that I would start by saying that just as the idea of progress is multifaceted and history can be quite complex, so the idea of religion can be quite complex. As I mentioned, Christianity in Europe at this time, even during the 18th century, was essentially changing and undergoing some changes, changes that began, so to speak, with the Protestant Reformation. And a lot of those changes began with the distribution of Bibles across Europe, which fundamentally kind of changed the religious superstructure, where individuals from the Protestant side of things were essentially able to read the scriptures for themselves and decide essentially what was religiously right and religiously wrong, which was something that was previously under the domain of the bishops. Now, that's a grand oversimplification, but the idea that, you know, we should have our own church or our own beliefs, and we should be able to, as congregations, and speaking, I guess, suppose from the Christian perspective, to practice our own beliefs, to understand our own beliefs, rather than turning to a centralized authority to dictate all of those beliefs for us, was something that was also developing in this time period. And so Christianity itself is not a static entity, is not something that always promotes violence and war, and it's not something that always promotes colonization either. So I think that there are some more gray areas there, but I think we should continue reading on with parts of this article, because there are some thinkers, especially in the French Enlightenment, who were great critics of religion. And so a lot of them are coming from some of the perspective that you've brought up, Michael. So let's read a little bit more. So Turgot and Concordat also hold that short-term decline can be part of a pattern of long-term improvement. In the intellectual realm, the path to truth is rocky and errors are frequent and the first result of reflection. For instance, the false scientific philosophy of faculties and essences is born of reflection on phenomena. In the realm of action, devastating events like war and conquest can ultimately unite scattered groups of people and amalgamate political organization. So this is essentially a positive argument for conquest. Moreover, Turgot argues that individuals and groups that contribute to progress are often motivated by emotion or personal interest. The second observation is related to the first, since Turgot thinks that the agents of creative destruction are usually narrowly self-interested or emotion-driven. Despite their many common convictions, Concordat and Turgot part ways on the question of religion. Turgot is generally positive about Christianity, while a significant part of Concordat's essay consists of polemics against religion, and especially priests. Concordat states that as scientific knowledge spreads, an enlightened population will throw off the shackles of religion and its priests and demand greater freedom. Do you have a comment on that before I go forward?
Well, I think it's turned out to be somewhat false, that that prediction that you just read, because we have a world which is very technological advanced, and yet religion has and does continue to be a very strong force. We have religious wars still going on. Many people die in the name of religion, particularly in the Middle East. So it doesn't seem that it's actually turned out that science has displaced religion at all. Seems like there's a sort of a parallel track, perhaps. There's certainly advancement of science, but it hasn't seemed to displace religion and religious forces and religious politics and religious dynamics in the world.
But if we think about the ideas of freedom of religion in the West, we can kind of trace that back to some of these Enlightenment ideas. And whether they were developed in England or France first is kind of a matter of contention, because the next thing that is talked about in this article, and we'll get into there in a little bit, is the Scottish Enlightenment as well. So there are multiple groups of people involved in this process, and even though we know a decent amount as historians, there's also a lot we don't know. And specifically, there's a lot I don't know, because I'm not a trained historian, or a very well-trained philosopher either. So still, I think we can definitely agree that we've seen these principles, especially in Western society, in Canadian and American society, come into the public discourse a lot in the modern age, especially, or at least I would say within my lifetime in the last 5 years, people have been demanding greater amounts of freedom and rights, freedoms of association, freedoms to gather together, freedoms of religion and expression. I think that you can see that there is, if not a reality of freedom, there is certainly a growing desire for freedom, or for different freedoms, you could say, in different areas of life, as we've seen a progression of Western civilization or European civilization.
Well, it's not clear that it's a permanent trend. So I would concede that over the last couple hundred years, there's been some development of Enlightenment ideas, the creation of some liberal democratic societies. Whether or not it's a temporary phenomenon or whether it will continue as part of a long-term trend is not yet known. We don't know yet. We see some evidence now of backlash against liberal democracy, against the types of freedom, religious freedom, and so on that you're talking about, Aaron. And we're seeing that pretty strong backlash against that in a lot of different countries, including the United States. And it's too early to tell whether we're looking at a temporary setback for liberal democracy, for Enlightenment ideas of freedom, or whether it's going to be a return back to the normal human state of authoritarianism and repression.
I would be very careful there of calling that the normal human state.
Well, I'm pretty careful about that. If you look back at human history, I think the idea of democracy, liberal democracy, is a very recent idea. Now, I understand that there was some direct democracy in places like Athens, but that was also fairly short-lived. Whether or not the more comprehensive idea of liberal democracy, and I'm distinguishing modern liberal democracy from the Athenian democracy, because Athenian democracy mostly talked about the direct vote of people to make decisions, right? People decided, they had these councils and they got together and made decisions by democratic vote. But our modern idea of liberal democracy is a much deeper, more comprehensive, more wide-ranging concept of democracy, much more than just voting and making decisions, but rather ideals such as what you just described, the idea of freedom of religion. But I would contend, I would assert that that's a very recent phenomenon, and it's not the norm in the history of human civilization. Whether or not it signifies a progression, or whether it's just a little blip, and we're going to go back to the way things were in the Middle Ages and before, is not yet known.
Yeah, so just to latch onto that point, we've been talking of an ideal of human progress, and if we held the European ideal of progress is correct, then based off of the evidence and history that we have seen or had seen, just for the sake of argument, then we would expect to see that progress spreading all over the world and having positive effects. And so whether or not the pushback that we see now is potentially the end of the idea of European progress, is a very interesting